I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show. Michael Jackson's career has raised the bar on what it is to be a superstar. His 1983 release Thriller is the best-selling album of all time, with 45 million copies sold worldwide. New York Times critic Margot Jefferson has examined Jackson's ascent and decline as the king of pop in a new book called On Michael Jackson. It's published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it's brought Margot Jefferson back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, he was spotted last week at a shopping mall in Bahrain wearing a burqa-like outfit.
Yes,
designed
indeed.
For women. If you can't be anonymous in a burqa in Bahrain, your life in public just doesn't really belong to you anymore.
No, I think that's fair. And it's possible that you don't altogether want to be anonymous in Bahrain.
He wants it both ways, you think?
I think he very often does. There was something in it that seemed to me so right. I felt, yes, he's found a kind of uniform. But, on the other hand, and then the baby burqa with a mask that the child was in.
Well, after he read a P.T. Barnum autobiography, was it an autobiography or just a
biography? Well, P.T. Barnum actually wrote 8 versions of his autobiography, so I'm not sure which one it was, but it was definitely an autobiography.
He gave copies to his staff and said, I want my career to be the greatest show on earth. So he succeeded, at least in that regard.
He did, and for a time, he succeeded brilliantly. Even the hoaxes, which were so much a part of Barnum's shtick, even the hoaxes were working for a time. The Elephant Man, the calling the National Enquirer reporters, so they say, to let them know about the hyperbaric chamber, where he would be looking like a pharaoh or like Snow White, whitening or
those
something.
Were hoaxes? Or the, they were...
That's what reporters claim. They say that he called them or his people called them to let them know. Do I believe he saw the Elephant Man many, many times and wept? Yes, he is sentimental in that way. Do I believe he bid for the bones? Yes, but it was all wildly advertised. But then he became his own product. You know, the impresarios always are able to keep their distance. If you're your own product, then you're devouring yourself.
Well, in the case of P.T. Barnum, he put freaks on display, but Michael has become the freak himself.
Exactly.
You ask, was he man-boy, or boy-woman? And I wonder if you've come to any conclusion on that.
I haven't, because Michael Jackson so shifts from image to image, or as people like to say, representation to representation. His whole career and life as a star has so been tied to, you know, incorporating this music style, learning those dance steps, mastering that, and then turning it into something else. Falling in love the way children do with all these fantasy objects. I think one reality is as real or imagistic as another to him. We don't know.
Now, in reading the reviews of this book, which range from, wow, this is great, to,
get this away from me.
Do you think that they should have understood something about your intentions by looking at the title, On Michael Jackson? Is this intended to some degree as a personal essay?
Yes, to some degree it is. And there's no way I can gracefully answer the question as you put it, meaning should they have? For one thing, I've spent too many years being a critic. I've been on one side. Now I'm on the other side. You know, here it is. It was meant to be a long essay. Essays allow you to wander in many directions, to ask questions, to conclude, and then to question again. And yes, it was, without being confessional or without containing a lot of autobiographical material, it was personal. Yes, I never would have done the book if I hadn't had personal as well as, you know, official critical passions.
Okay, so let's talk about the personal. Obviously, this is not about your personal life, but how did you connect to Michael Jackson to the point where you would have wanted to write a meditation on him?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the way so many people did, just as an uncanny talent. there is a particular kind of performer who just, you know, actor, musician, dancer, who has something especially kinetic that always lets you feel something's being improvised. Brando at his best has that quality. Suzanne Farrell had it. The best tap dancers have it. Savion Glover has it. Michael Jackson always had that ability to surprise, and that enchanted me. I've got a sort of fascination with child stars, you know, which goes back to being shamelessly smitten by, you know, everyone from Shirley Temple to Margaret O'Brien to little Freddie Bartholomew as a girl. That just interests me. Very precocious children who are simultaneously children and adults.
Well, let's talk about that whole child star thing. Do you think it's distorted every one of those people?
Everyone is tricky. It has distorted virtually all of the ones who didn't find some way to remove themselves, at least for a time, from the business. Some, like Shirley Temple, simply retired. Others, say like Jodie Foster, you know, she pulls back. She has some years in college. That gives her the time to re-enter in a different way with a different self instead of, I mean, performing self.
And then people like Macaulay Culkin obviously have been upset by it as well.
Yeah, and even people like Elizabeth Taylor, for example.
You say child stars are abused by the culture. Are we really the problem here?
We're not the only problem. You know, look, ultimately people are responsible for their lives. Brooke Shields seems to have turned out very well. But yeah, if the culture extends from their families to their employers, the big movie studios, the record companies, to the way we devour them and demand, you know, that they perform and give out to us and, you know, really be like little automatons, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, this it's a terrible thing to be worried every year of your young life that you're going to grow old, you know, literally before your time. You're supporting adults, you know, your fans are adults. I mean, Graham Greene nailed it when he talked in a 1930s essay about Shirley Temple's little hard, vivacious sexuality and all the clergymen and family men that it appealed to. You know, and Shirley Temple, though one of the most contained and controlled autobiographers you'll ever find, does have telling little passages about just the hard, cold facts.
She was aware.
Oh, she was quite aware, yeah.
Michael once reminisced that as a Jehovah's Witness, he'd sometimes have to make visits to people's homes to recruit new members. But he was already famous, so he'd have to be in some disguise. And he said that those moments in ordinary homes, watching television with normal children being a normal child, were some of the happiest of all of his memories.
It's so strange, isn't it? And you accept those statements. You do. How could they not be? And yet there is that sense always that it's pure felt sentimentality, and yet it's also a little performed.
Yeah. It's an outsider sensibility.
Exactly.
Too.
And it's a longing voyeur who's very, very aware that he's being watched even as he watches them.
Well, how much do you believe the family becoming Jehovah's Witnesses affected his experience of the world?
From all that I've read about Jehovah's Witnesses, I think it affected them a lot. For one thing, you know, it is a proselytizing religion. You want everyone in your family, and in fact in your neighborhood or city, to become a believer. It is very isolating and isolated. You know, it's those, you're the chosen people, you are the ones who are supposed to be together. Then you had that terrible split between Catherine, the long-suffering maternal believer, and Joseph, a philanderer, an abuser. The theology dictates to women that if they find themselves in an unhappy marriage, they must try to improve the husband and they must live with it because they made a mistake to begin with and perhaps shouldn't have. So the boys are divided between a mother who is clearly the kinder figure, albeit a very passive one, and this father who's taken over their lives as manager, as show business teacher. He's on the road with them. That's a terrible division anyway. Add religion to it. And the fact that when they're on the road with Joseph, there he is philandering, and they go home, and they're not supposed to tell Mommy, and they're not supposed to have these desires anyway. And Michael, as one of the youngest, of course, takes the mythology of that very much in.
As you say, sexualized by all these experiences. But he also said of his childhood, no birthdays, no Christmases, no happy memories of fun and play, only work and sacrifice.
Well, that...
Partly because of religious rules, but yes. you get a sense that he was being worked really hard. On the other hand, he lived a life that many people would envy, wouldn't he?
Sure. Who doesn't dream of being whatever their chosen fantasy field?
Well, you're a multimillionaire. What's the difference if you have Christmas or a birthday or not?
Well,
you have everything you'd want anyway.
Not when you're young. That money is being managed by Dad. You are working all the time. The notion of failure, it's bad enough, don't you think, when you're a kid and you're afraid of failing? Boy, you know, when billions of dollars, family approval, public approval depend on it, I think that's hellish. I do.
Let's take a little break, and when we come back, talk about the racial aspect of all of this story.
Por favor.
Margot Jefferson has written for the New York Times since 1993, received the Pulitzer Prize in 1995. Her reviews and essays have also appeared in The Nation, Vogue, Grand Street, The Village Voice, American Theater, Dance, Inc., and Harper's. And her latest book is on Michael Jackson. It is published by Pantheon. We're back with Margot Jefferson, who has written a book called On Michael Jackson. It is published by Pantheon. Michael really was an incredible, or is, I guess, still an incredible dancer. From 1964 to 1968, when they were just making it big, he studied every act. He learned moves from James Brown by actually watching James Brown. But how much of his dancing is of his own creation, other than the moonwalk? Did he invent the moonwalk?
He didn't invent the moonwalk, actually. He learned it from a young dancer, closer to street and then studio, whose name I now forget. You would also find old tappers like Honey Cole saying, and actually, I've witnessed this in old footage, there were steps like the moonwalk in their generation. I think his genius as a dancer, and it is that, is the way he would combine portions of other steps, whole steps, the way he would mix those, fast, say, kicks and twists with utter stillness, the silhouettes, this, sense that the arms could be out of musical theater, but the feet could be out of James Brown, and then go back and be out of Josephine Baker. It's really the combination of elements. It's really so original.
Well, how dependent was he on choreographers for the way he danced? I know he used the same choreographer that Madonna did.
He used Vince Patterson. He also used Michael Peters, who had a Broadway history. Michael Peters plays the black Latinish gang leader in Beat It. And Michael Peters choreographed a number of Broadway shows. He gives various choreographers co-credit, but,
I doubt that any of them told him to grab his crotch all the time.
No, I think that was very individual.
That was him.
Yeah. But, he did a good number of it himself. And, part of being in that way, film, dance, and music are like, you know, every other kind of movie making. You know, part of the genius, if you are a genius, is picking the right collaborators.
How much of the ambiguous racial aspect of all of this just grows out of the fact that he performed on Motown, which set out to woo both black and white listeners? And the Jackson Five were always a crossover act.
They were always a crossover act. And, you know, luck of the historical draw coming along in the 70s, they were able to move into a culture that, on, you know, sort of gilded pop terms, was ready for chipper, all-American, leave-it-to-beaver kinds of black Americans. The Jacksons became the black family values, you know, up from working-class family. Michael started setting, and his brothers, pop clones, white pop clones in motion, the Osmonds, you know, the Partridges, etc. So, you know, that was partly good timing. Yeah, I know what you mean about Motown. I think that we are, frankly, too cynical about Motown and its young America, code for young white and black America. Big deal. It is popular music. It is not, you know, it is not folk music. It is, you know, it's not trying to be pure. Every form of popular music, from vaudeville songs, you know, to certain hip hop recordings, they are meant to synthesize and smooth out a lot of elements we'd call ethnic, folkloric, community, and present them in a way that masses can take in. That's all Motown was doing.
Well,
and they did it brilliantly.
There have been lots of psychological profiles of people who depend on plastic surgery and who remake themselves. How much of Michael's remaking of himself is racially... I don't know if you've ever spoken to him, and
no,
you can answer this question, but how much of it is racially motivated, and how much of it is just that he's a strange person? He's also blurring his sex and
exactly.
His age.
Yes, very much so. We will never really know, because we've got so much damned circumstantial evidence, you know, to hold up. Oh, you know, he only surrounds himself with white people. Does he really have vitiligo, this disease in which, you know, if you're brown, your pigment lightens in patches? And he says that's why he wears all this makeup and is probably undergoing, you know, experimental depigmentation treatments. From everything I could find, he does have vitiligo. That's a big thing.
But he's also been a shapeshifter, and you seem to attribute some of the fascination with physical reinvention to an event he witnessed involving a stripper when he was still a very young boy.
The transvestite stripper.
Now, he was, how old was he?
He was, it would have been, I think he said around 1963. It's in the book, but I don't remember the dates. He was not yet an adolescent. No, couldn't have been 63. Sorry, he was born in 58. So let's say late 60s. And there he is at, maybe it's the Apollo. And there is this woman, as he sees it, who is knocking them dead with this great, sexy act. And, you know, to get these audiences going, at the end, she takes oranges out of her blouse. And he realizes it's a man. And this I'm taking from his memoir. And he writes, you know, I was absolutely blown away. And what's interesting in the way he writes about it is this double consciousness of the performer who thinks, oh, ho, you know, chills and thrills. And the kid who says, oh, my God, I was watching this stuff trying to figure it out. I think that his sense of and his need for the theatrical, turning anything he sees into something presentational, theatrical, is acute, uncanny. I think at a certain point it permeated his life and probably took it over, to say the least.
You call him a sexual impersonator, imitating at times a gay man, a white woman, a gangster, and a pop count Dracula.
Well, it's true. Think of all those videos. And he's been a sexual impersonator since he was a little boy, imitating grown men,
but there,
which we loved, which we thought was enchanting.
And we don't know whether he's gay or straight or whether he has any sexuality.
We do not know, and you know what? We may never know.
There was a headline in The Onion once that read, "Enchanted by his own innocence, Michael Jackson molests self."
Mm-hmm.
But and
very
that,
good.
It
and
seems
in a funny way, you know. But I think one of the things that is so scary and unsettling and repulsive to some people is that the surgery, the costumes, do feel like a form of, you know, caricature into a kind of self molestation and self abuse.
Well, what about the other members of his family? His sister has had similar nose surgery.
Both of his sisters. I mean, no one cares about LaToya, but yeah. God knows she's had it, as has Janet.
Were they all screwed up by the experience of being child stars as well?
They weren't all. Well, LaToya, you know, wasn't so much. I think they were all screwed up. They're a wreck. You know, it's, I think I say in the book, something icky about quoting your own book, but nevertheless, here I am, that, you know, I say, well, let's look at all the siblings. Here's the body count. And I did mean that. This is a damaged family. I think a number of things happened. They had simple stuff. They had a father, you know, who was always making fun of them. He helped teach them to call each other things like, you know, liver lips and big nose. The culture didn't help, you know.
They're not the only children who went through that.
No, they're not.
And others do not do to themselves what Michael Jackson
did. That's where show business and all these lies, lying about your age, lying about so much kicks in. There are also theories, and which Joe Jackson has addressed, that one of the things Michael wanted least in the world was to go through the rest of his adult life with his father's nose. He wanted to look as little like his father as possible. And Joe said, well, what's the matter with my nose? Well, if you watched the family coming into the courtroom together during the trial, it was the strangest thing imaginable. He has done it. He has entirely severed any recognizable biological connection to the men in the family. What's interesting is that even pre-plastic surgery, Maureen, the oldest, and LaToya both had looks that represent Michael's first stage of transformation before Diana Ross, then Elizabeth Taylor, then Jackie O, and then God knows what.
Why do you think people care so much? Why doesn't the public just write him off? After all, he hasn't had a hit record in quite a while. So is he washed up, or is his career kept alive by the New York Post and other publications that continue to give him headline status with Jacko did this and Jacko did that?
I wouldn't say his career is kept alive so much as, you know, the presence, the reputation of, as, you know, this creature we're all obsessed with. You know, he is still selling around the world in many places. Also, no one who heard him and saw him, especially at his best, who still sees those videos, and he made a number of good ones after he, you know, had crossed his peak. No one can forget that, you know, he was, and in that way still is, one of our great entertainers.
He sure knew how to make a record that forced you to tap your foot.
Yes, and he knew how to move in a way that really nobody else does. I'm not saying he's the greatest dancer in history. I'm saying he's one of our great vernacular dancers.
Although you do also say that the song Ben, which is a slow, fervent pledge of love to a feral rat, may be the most emotionally open-hearted love song he ever performed.
I do.
Margo Jefferson's On Michael Jackson is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. It's close to me.